This is the Happy Station, broadcasting to North and South America on 9,955 kilohertz from 1 to 155 UTC and from 15 to 1555 UTC.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Happy Station presents a tribute to DXers, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Well, hello everyone. It's really nice to have you with me once again for another 55 minutes. And this program is a special one, and it is going to be very interesting and hopefully a lot of fun as well, because this show, this edition of Happy Station, is going to pay tribute to a group of people. And it's a group of people who for decades, and I mean decades, have been providing international broadcasters with information that most international broadcasters probably would have no other way to get. And that is the DXers. Going back as far as many of you can probably remember, even more than me, have been writing to international shortwave stations to let them know on signal strength and propagation of their signal in whatever area. Now, DXers do span the globe. They're in North America, South America, Europe, both Eastern and Western, Asia Pacific, China, India, even little Fiji, and even some other little islands as well. So this program is for all of you, as well as for those who are interested in knowing more about DXing and more about radio. So this is for all of you today. Now, today's show is very interesting because we have a lot of special guests to get to on today's show, so there's not going to be room for that much music. But I thought to begin today's show, let's make it a little bit timely because, as you know, North Korea has been in the news lately. So I thought to open up today's show, a song dedicated to all the DXers out there and to all those who are fans of shortwave radio. We're going to take a listen to a song that is played every day on North Korean radio and North Korean television in the DPRK, or otherwise known as North Korea. The song is called No Motherland Without You, and it's performed by the North Korean Armed Forces Military Chorus with the orchestra by the State Radio and Television Symphony Orchestra. No Motherland Without You, beginning today's special edition of Happy Station.
Oh,
No Motherland Without You, a song that's played every day on television and radio in the DPRK, North Korea. And we're beginning with that because, well, North Korea has been in the news lately, and I thought that you would probably find that song very interesting. Now, the song is about Kim Jong-il and about his superpowers. Yes, you heard me correctly, superpowers. So, anyway, that is beginning today's show. Now, today's show, like I said earlier, is called A Tribute to DXers because, as I said, they have provided through the years a lot of information to international broadcasters like Radio Canada International, Voice of America, Radio France International, Radio Nederland, and many others, a wealth of information on signal strength and propagation in whatever region they are living. And a lot of this information is something that most international broadcasters, or practically all of them, would never have been able to get any other way. So we're dedicating the show to the DX community and, of course, to people in general who love radio. Now, to begin with, in the first part of the show, I want to talk about some of the chatter that's been going on a lot of the DX blogs. And that has to do with some music that is interfering with radio stations broadcasting to a specific region. Now, I'm not going to tell you what it is yet, but let's take a little listen to it. And I'm sure there's a number of you out there will guess right away after the first, you know, few seconds. Well, as you probably guessed, that was the infamous Fire Drake that China uses to jam international broadcasters broadcasting to China in programs in Mandarin and Tibetan and others. So we're going to talk about jamming for a moment because today, of course, is June the 4th, and I think we should. Now, to talk about jamming, there is a lot of people that I could have contacted, but I decided to go to an international broadcaster that has suffered more from jamming than any other. That is the Voice of America. Now, during the Cold War era, the Soviet Union jammed the VOA, Cuba jams the VOA, and so does China. So I contacted Bill Whitaker in the public relations office of the Voice of America to talk to him about Fire Drake and jamming with Cuba. Bill, you know, as you know, many years ago, the Soviet Union was very infamous for jamming the VOA in Russia. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Voice of America is no longer being jammed by the Russians, but it seems that now China has taken jamming to a whole new level. How does the VOA get around jamming, or how did it deal with jamming, for example, first in the days of the Soviet Union?
Well, traditionally, our approach to jamming has always been just to put more stuff on the air. There's really no way to evade jamming. For a very short period, we were able to use the Tangier relay station to propagate into parts of Western Russia when their jamming from Central and Eastern Russia couldn't propagate because of a twilight immunity kind of a thing, where we had a higher MUF than the jammer did. And people could hear us on very high frequencies, but that was a kind of a unique geographic opportunity that didn't last, you know, but a couple hours every evening, maybe. In the case of China, it's been basically the same. If we put on 8 or 10 or 12 frequencies, there's some hope that one or more of them will get through. Chinese have been very efficient at jamming, and they catch up with changes that we make, and they are able to cover just about anything that we put on pretty well.
Well, something that's very different about the jamming that comes from China, the Soviets, which would use a noise or something, China is broadcasting either Fire Drake, which is the traditional Chinese classical music, or they're also putting domestic stations on shortwave frequencies.
Yeah, that's what we hear most of. I just listened to some this morning before you called, VOA frequencies from today, and all I heard was co-channel China National Radio stuff. And you know, it varies what they use depending on the political sensitivities or what they have handy, and it also depends on the broadcaster. Some broadcasters are more susceptible to the we call it Chinese opera jamming than we are, RFA in particular, or other languages like Tibetan, which they really want to cover up a little bit more than they even worry about Mandarin. So it just depends. But all of it is very effective. It's multiple use of transmitters. There's some indication of some ground wave jamming in larger cities, and it's a pretty big affair.
but with jamming, has the VOA ever looked at the possibility that some people have suggested maybe switching frequencies quite often?
No, you lose more listeners than you ever retain that way, because we figure I've personally seen most listeners are not sitting there with digital shortwave radios, communications receivers to chase you. They've got a slide rule dial, an older radio, or a cheap radio, and if I were them, I'd be scared to move that thing for fear of never being able to find the frequency that I was originally on. And I think that's the case. Those few people that are still listening to shortwave are probably using cheap radios or very old radios. And I've never seen any payback from that, because there's only so many frequencies on the band. And if you move very often or to very many, you're going to start interfering with other people on the band.
Now, the jamming from China, do they also interfere with broadcasts not targeted towards China but to other areas of the Asia Pacific?
I don't think they pay much attention to Cantonese anymore. We've shown that they do jam, oddly enough, not VOA, but or not RFE, but VOA Uzbek broadcasts, as well as BBC Uzbek. And our theory has always been that it's because it's understandable by Uyghurs that they jam that. But other than that, that's about all they do, just directly.
And what about broadcasts in Korean?
Well, we don't know that it's the Chinese. We have more reason. We're fairly certain it's the North Koreans that jam any, rather ineffectively, but try and jam broadcasts in Korean. We don't have any indication that the Chinese are lending them any assistance in that.
Right. Now, the Voice of America, being a U.S. government organization like most other international broadcasters, does the VOA, to your knowledge, have meetings with Chinese officials about jamming, or is that something that there's no point of mentioning it because it's not going to change anything?
We've only discussed it directly with them once back in 1993, and it was in the run-up to a summer signing of the Most Favored Nation Agreement treaty, and the Chinese wanted to see that signed. So it took a number of steps that we wanted taken in order to kind of ameliorate our government. And one of them was to have direct talks about what we called mutual interference issues. And we held those discussions for about 3 days in different meetings. And on the very day that we were supposed to assign some accord with them, which would not have said a whole lot except that we had discussed these things, President Clinton then signed the Most Favored Nation Agreement, and the meeting was immediately canceled. So it was clear to me, at least, and I think most of the people there at the embassy, that the meetings were in order to take care of any issues that remained before Most Favored Nation treaty was signed, and that was about it. Other than that, it doesn't get mentioned, nor does it with most other nations, and nor has it ever with the Soviet Union or Cuba. So it's not acceptable. We send in complaints on a monthly basis to the ITU, and to the Chinese, to the Cubans, and anyone else jamming us. And that's basically just to, you know, follow the paper trail.
Now, with the jamming, let's say, that is done by Cuba or China, is it really effective from a listener point of view, or are Cuba and China just spending way too much money to block international broadcasts that are getting in anyway?
The effectiveness of the Chinese jamming is quite real. It's very effective, and it would prevent most people, unless they were extremely determined, to listen to our broadcasts and those of RFA and other people who are jammed. And whereas the Cuban jamming is not so effective, and it's difficult for them because it's a small island and there are skip zones, and it's difficult to block our marquee's broadcasts. But nonetheless, they make a valid effort, I think.
Now, you know, with China, the thing that I'm surprised about is the China, which is a member of the ITU. What is the ITU's reaction when VOA or other broadcasts complain to them about the jamming in China?
None that I've seen.
Right.
The Chinese are also a member of the HFCC and set at tables in the same room with the rest of us and coordinate their frequency usage. So
right.
I don't really think that one doesn't seem to bear relation to the other.
Right. Is that because maybe they don't see it as being important?
I don't know why it is.
Yeah.
I don't think they are bothered by it, so they don't. It's not as big an issue for them.
And I was speaking there with Bill Whitaker from the Voice of America. Now, how is jamming fed to the various different transmitter sites around China? Now, each transmission station doesn't have a tape loop that they just run over and over and over. No, it's controlled in Beijing and fed via satellite to first the largest jamming transmitting station in China, which is located on Hainan Island, and then from there again by satellite to various other transmitting relay stations. Now, how do I know and how do we know that the Fire Drake signals on satellite? Well, it was discovered by a guy by the name of Mark Fahey all the way in Australia. So I contacted him to find out how he came across it.
It's very easy to find, actually. So it was simply mixed in with other Chinese domestic radio feeds going to various transmitters. I found the Fire Drake audio.
Now, when you found the Fire Drake using the one of the carriers for one of the domestic Chinese broadcasters, which is China National Radio, was it on the left channel, right channel, or were they using a sub-carrier on the main channel?
Yeah, it was on. It's simply one of the network was in mono, and on the left audio channel was the regular radio signal for that network. And this happened to be on the right channel. So actually on a stereo receiver, you were hearing one broadcast out of one speaker and you were hearing Fire Drake out of the other.
Now, what's really interesting to me, Mark, about the Fire Drake music is that it's exactly 60 minutes long, not a second shorter and not a second longer.
That's right. What's very interesting is that at the end of the musical piece, it seems that the transmitter turns off for maybe 30 seconds or so, and then turns back on. And so occasionally you'll get a snippet of a program which is underneath on the same frequency, and I assume that's the program they're jamming. And other times it will just be dead air, and I assume the program is finished that they were jamming. But it's all very intriguing.
The fact that you've released it as a CD is very interesting, and you kind of wonder like what the government in China thinks and what they must be saying to themselves. They're probably saying, you know, this is going against what we're trying to do with jamming.
Well, I actually did, attempt to contact someone in Beijing or wherever to say that, you know, I was just in a very limited way planning to make a CD of the Fire Drake signal. And of course, I didn't expect to receive any reply and didn't. But, the audio may be covered by a copyright or it obviously was played by someone. So in making the CD available, I've made it clear that I'm not selling the content. I'm simply providing it. And in most cases, it's gone to people that want to use it for academic research.
And I was speaking there with Mark Fahey, who discovered the signal that is on satellite that is used to feed the various different jamming transmitter sites around China. Now, let's stay on China for one moment, because today, June the 4th, 1989, is the 20th anniversary of what is known in China as the incident of what happened in Tiananmen Square. Now, we all know about that. Now, something that people may not realize who didn't listen 20 years ago or who are new at the DXing hobby, DXers actually were some of the first group of people, and those listening on shortwave, to find out what had actually happened in China from listening to the BBC and other international broadcasters. Now, there was one broadcast in particular that gave almost exact confirmation that of what had transpired in Tiananmen Square. Now, I'd wonder how many of you heard this originally in 1989.
This is Radio Beijing. Please remember June the 3rd, 1989. The most tragic event happened in the Chinese capital, Beijing. Thousands of people, most of them innocent civilians, were killed by fully armed soldiers when they forced their way into the city. Among the killed are our colleagues at Radio Beijing. The soldiers were riding on armored vehicles and used machine guns against thousands of local residents and students who tried to block their way. When the army convoys made a breakthrough, soldiers continued to spray their bullets indiscriminately at crowds in the street. Eyewitnesses say some armored vehicles even crushed foot soldiers who hesitated in front of the resisting civilians. Radio Beijing English Department deeply mourns those died in a tragic incident and appeals to all its listeners to join our protest for the gross violation of human rights and the most barbarous oppression of the people. Because of the abnormal situation here in Beijing, there is no other news we could bring you. We sincerely ask for your understanding and thank you for joining us at this most tragic moment.
Now, many of you, at some point or another, have heard that clip. That, of course, was a very brave newsreader on Radio Beijing, now known as China Radio International, who went on the air with that some 20 years ago on June 4th in, way back in 1989. So, quite interesting. The first time, actually, that I heard that clip was not from listening to Radio Beijing, but when the BBC World Service was cutting to its correspondent in Beijing to report on the situation, when he cut back to London, BBC World Service said, we just had this clip sent to us from, I don't remember who it was, and they ran it. So the first time I heard it was on BBC World Service. Anyway, quite interesting. Very interesting indeed. Okay, now we've had a lot of very seriousness on The Happy Station, which is not supposed to be a serious show, but, you know, for the special edition, sometimes we can do things a little differently. But now, from this point onward, it's going to be more light and, of course, more happy. Well, it is Happy Station, of course. So let's now talk about the DXers. The DXers are, like I said earlier, a very special group of people who have provided international broadcasters with a wealth of information. And throughout the world, there are a number of DX clubs. And they have meetings and they also hold activities. And one of them that has been a big supporter of the revival of Happy Station is the British DX Club. So I decided to contact Mark Savage, who's with the British DX Club, and I first began by asking him, do they have many international members?
We've got quite a reasonably sized international membership, and indeed always have done since the club started in 1974. In fact, when we advertise outside the UK, we tend to call ourselves BDXC UK to avoid confusion with any other club that might be using those letters of the alphabet.
Yes, there's a club in Belgium, which I was told about sounds the same.
That's right. I think they have actually changed their initials now, which helps us a bit, but it did used to cause a lot of confusion, so we did a kind of make arrangements to avoid that confusion. But within the UK, you know, we're generally pretty well known as BDXC. And along with other DX clubs, you know, we're well known over here, really.
Now, for members, what kind of activities do you organise?
Well, the main focus is our monthly magazine, which has well, the very good title, really, of communication. I think that kind of says it all. And that's still sent through the post to members once a month. In fact, we've always been very proud of our turnaround on the bulletin. In fact, it's going to press the... people should be receiving their current edition just about the time this edition of Happy Station's going out, actually, Keith. We aim to get it out within about 10 days to people at the start of the month, so that if there are any changes to schedules and things, that people hear about them then. But, of course, you know, we're aware of the impact of the internet, and so we've also got a website, which members and indeed anybody else is able to use free of charge. And something that's been going for about 33 years now is the BDXC Audio Circle, which was originally known as Tape Circle, and that goes to about 30 or 40 of our members, and people sort of share their recordings of shortwave and various other bits and have discussions on the numerous topics that come about. And apart from all that, we try to get together socially at meetings in various parts of the UK, and indeed there have even been meetings overseas as well from time to time. So we're a pretty active bunch.
Now, with the audio content, have you ever thought of maybe starting a pirate radio station to have your own show?
the least said about that, the better. I think maybe some of our members might have had interest in that in a dim, distant past, but I think... these days, we try to stay within the law. So, of course, individual members might well be involved with pirate radio, but that is no responsibility of BDXC.
Mm. Now, with membership, is it much more challenging now to get new members than, let's say, 15 or 20 years ago?
Oh, good heavens, yes, it certainly is. Obviously, as we've mentioned already, the impact of the internet, and that is inevitably is... is giving us a harder deal in trying to get our presence felt, as it were, in a very crowded communications marketplace. And the other thing is, it tends to be a hobby which certainly existing members, so perhaps of an older demographic, people in their middle age and older years. But having said that, we've got quite a lot of our active club team, those that put the bulletin together, are actually younger people, people in their teens. Our shortwave editor actually started editing the section when he was 14, I think, 14 or 15. So we still attract the younger demographic, but it is getting harder to do so, certainly.
And I was speaking there with Mark Savage from the British DX Club. Now, one of my favorite things about radio are radio stories and anecdotes about what goes on behind the scenes that listeners tuning to whatever their favorite international shortwave station is they probably wouldn't even know what happened. But there's a lot of funny stories out there. And when I was putting together today's show, the big challenge I had was, what do I keep in and what do I throw away? And what do I keep for maybe a future show? And there were so many that we can't take a listen to all of them right now. But for the first anecdote, which is really funny, I decided to contact my good friend Stuart Parkins. Now, some of you who listen to China Radio International may know that name. Stuart worked at China Radio International for over 10 years. He hosted the Listener's Corner. He also hosted a program on Chinese cooking. And he also hosted a series called Let's Learn Chinese. Now, with the years that Stuart was at CRI, of course, he must have had some funny stories. And I remembered one that he told me way back in probably 2004 or 2005. So I decided to call him up and to tell me this story once again.
Anyway, the story went something like this. This is how I read on the radio. Hi, everybody. Well, today is International Chicken Appreciation Day. Now, United Nations Chicken Appreciation Day. Everybody's heard of UN Women's Day, Children's Day, Environment Day, all these things. But for some reason, the UN International Chicken Appreciation Day has never quite hit the headlines. Anyway, we're going to remedy that today. And to commemorate this special occasion, we're going to have not one, but two egg dishes. And then I continued with the program. And later that afternoon, there were two very nice elderly women who were sort of original people on the English service, going back to the 1930s or something. And they used to sort of vet and listen to everything to make sure it was PC. And they stopped me in the corridor and they said, "Oh, Mr. Bai, my Chinese name, Bai White, we listened to your program and we've checked all everywhere we can and we can't find any reference to the United Nations International Chicken Appreciation Day. Could you tell us something more?" And off the cuff, because I wasn't prepared for this, I said, "Oh, on this day in 1983, in order to promote the raising of chickens by peasant farmers in the Third World, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome, they instigated, they started the International Chicken Appreciation Day. And every year it's been on, and that's what we celebrated today." "Oh, thank you so much. Yes, thank you." The next day, I'm walking down the corridor, and they were looking at me a little bit sort of frightened, and I said, "Oh, hello. By the way, yesterday, remember United Nations International Chicken Appreciation Day?" "Yes." I said, "It doesn't exist." And, they nearly died. "Oh, Mr. Parkins, we can't give our listeners incorrect information like that." Well, Keith, need I say more?
Stuart, I don't think you can say more on that one. And I have to let you know that Stuart is the one who kept me sane working at China Radio International. His sense of humor is just as warped as mine. Well, let's now move to an embarrassing anecdote of something that happened to Bob Zanotti. Now, Bob Zanotti was one of the hosts of the Swiss merry-go-round on Swiss Radio International for many years with Bob Thurman. So, Bob, what do you have for us?
Well, Keith, during the 24 years that Bob Thurman and I did the Swiss shortwave merry-go-round together, we had a pretty peaceful and happy relationship with the DX or SWL community. 2 points, though, did create a little bit of a hassle. Number one, our campaign to get people to listen to what we called program content rather than just go for QSL cards and signal reports. That was not appreciated by all of the DXing and SWLing community. But what I will remember, I suppose, the most is before that time, I believe it was back in 1967, probably at a meeting of the European DX Council in Umeå, Sweden. I was working at the time as a freelancer for Radio Sweden in Stockholm, and I was presenting, among other things, Arne Skog's Sweden Calling DXers. Well, as sort of the DX presenter, I was invited along to Umeå to be on hand, and there was a discussion going on about some topics, and the question of what is the ideal reporting code came up. Well, as you know, there is a classic reporting code called the SINPO, Signal Interference Noise Propagation and Overall. Then there's the SIO, Signal Interference and Overall, which is much simpler to use. Well, to make a long story short, I was fairly new to the European DXing scene at the time, and I was just as outspoken then as I am today. And I never liked the SINPO code because I thought it was cumbersome, I thought it was complicated. It was asking for material that only engineers could evaluate. It was simply too complex, too rigid, and I said so in front of the masses there in Umeå at the European DX Council conference. Well, after I'd had my say, somebody stepped up and said, "Well, that's very interesting because the SINPO code has been regarded for many years as the cornerstone of DXing and SWL reporting codes, and we just happen to have the inventor of the SINPO code here with us, Mr. Gustav Thiele, who parenthetically was the technical director of the Deutsche Welle." And I looked over to Mr. Thiele, whom I did not know personally at the time, and he gave me a rather stern look and began to defend his SINPO code. Was I embarrassed at the time?
Well, thank you very much, Bob Zanotti, for that fun, embarrassing anecdote about SINPO and yourself. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to The Happy Station, a special edition of the show that I'm calling A Tribute to DXers, because we're talking about DXing
international radio and so many other things. My next two guests on the show, one of them is definitely well known. He hosted for many years a show called the SWL Digest on Radio Canada International. Well, you probably know by now that is Ian McFarland. He also worked for a couple of years at Radio Japan before he retired and is now living in Victoria on the west coast of Canada in British Columbia. He is going to be joined with me with Colin Newell, who runs a website called DXer, that's DXER.ca. Now, for those who listen to the SWL Digest, as you may remember, and for those who don't remember, I'll tell you now, but Ian did a series on interval signals, which was featuring different interval signals from radio stations all around the world. Well, a few years ago, he released a number of them on tape, and he also released a number of them on CD to raise money for a charity that he volunteers for. Anyway, now series three is ready, and this one is called Then and Now, 20 Years of Shortwave Broadcasting. Well, I'm now joined by Colin Newell and Ian McFarland, all the way on the west coast of Canada. Hello to both of you, but first I'd like to begin with you, Ian, to ask you, where did you get the idea for this?
Well, I got the idea that a lot of people would enjoy hearing a large number of different ident signals. Because, of course, if you're a DXer, a lot of these ident signals, you can hear them, but you don't really know what they are or where they're coming from. So I decided to put a series together, and we had about 100, a couple over 100 of these ident signals and interval signals and ident announcements. And, of course, a lot of them are in foreign languages. And a lot of DXers, if they only speak English, they're not going to understand a Russian ident announcement or any other language. So I figured this is a good way to get people familiar with an ident signal. And once mm-hmm. they've heard it on the program, they can put it away in their memory or they can tape it themselves at home. And then they could identify the station if they ever came across it on the shortwave bands. And it was a very popular series, and it ran for a number of months because I only ran about maybe two or three a week on the program. So it lasted quite a while.
Now, when you were putting it together, how did you compile the material for it? You didn't sit by a radio yourself and record stuff, right?
No. Some of them I got our monitoring station in Stittsville, that's RCI's monitoring station in Stittsville, to record quite a few of them. The others I got directly from the stations involved. Radio Moscow supplied quite a few, and the BBC, and a number of other stations, so we got good, clear signal on those. It wasn't all full of static and fading, so it gave people a good idea of what it sounded like.
Do you remember some of the most unusual stations?
Well, there were a few of the regional USSR stations that I got, because Radio Moscow gave me quite a grab bag of different station identification signals, and a lot of these you couldn't get off shortwave because they were so hard to hear, at least in North America they were. So this was a great help, and that Soviet part of the series ran to quite a few. There were probably about 15 different idents from the USSR at that time.
You know, here in Asia, there are some very unusual ones that I can pick up. The most interesting ones seem to be coming from, like, the Philippines, where they have, I don't know why they're doing this, but they put so much reverb on the interval signals that it sounds like the person is in an echo chamber in a recording studio. It's very funny. And also, of course, the ones from the DPRK in North Korea.
Yeah. Well, a lot of those are just bad recordings to begin with, I guess. And there's nothing you can do to get around that. And of course, it's further aggravated or degraded by the fact that you're hearing it on shortwave. So unless it's a really good recording to begin with, what you're going to get, say, in North America from Asia is not going to sound all that good. And that was right. The advantage that this series had. You got a good, clear signal on these idents.
Well, let's move to today, because you did the first series, Series 1, a few years ago. How was this something that you had wanted to do for a long time, or was it Colin's idea?
No, I had the idea. It was just the fact that I ran it in the mid-1970s on the program, and then subsequently I put them on cassette tapes, and they were sold by the Handicapped Aid Program to raise funds for that program. And that, of course, about 15 or 20 years later, I thought to myself, well, there are going to be a lot of new shortwave listeners that might be interested in this ident series. So Colin and I decided to put it out on a CD. And it sold quite a few copies. Between that series and the second CD set that we put out, we raised about $2,000. And these sales are a means of fundraising for the food bank in Duncan, British Columbia that I volunteer with. Mm-hmm. So it raised quite a bit of money for the food bank.
Right. Colin, let's move to you for a moment. I mean, what was it like putting together this series? And can you give me a little bit of your background as a shortwave listener?
Certainly. I've been a broadcast listener and shortwave listener since about 1971 or 72. I was, in fact, a very young fan of Ian McFarland in the mid-70s and was a regular on one of his shows. So I probably heard the Interval Signal series when it first came out in the mid to late 70s. I actually have some original cassette recordings of those. Of course, 25, 35 years ago, they're, you know, old and kind of scratchy cassette tapes. So I now had the original reel-to-reel tape of the Interval Signals, you know, fresh from the studio to use as a remastering material for the CD. So it was quite a blast from the past to have these reels of tape in my hand and put some pretty solid copies onto CD. The bulk of the email I've had from a lot of people that were buying the CDs were saying the same thing. It's like, we're hearing this shortwave material and these interval signals like we've never heard them before, and it feels so good to go back in time for a moment, back in the shortwave heyday of the mid-70s.
I should add at this point, Keith, that I've always been a bit of a pack rat. So when I retired from RCI in 1991, I still had all of the tapes from the major series that I ran on the program over the years. I had the ident signal on the original tapes that I used on the air. And also another popular series that I ran on the air was the language recognition course. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the second set of CDs that we put out. So between one thing and another, we've got a lot of archive material to put onto CDs that will be a bit of nostalgia for my listeners from the 70s onwards, and also something which will be relatively fresh for anybody who's only been listening for the last 10 years or so, because I haven't been on the air since, I guess, 1993.
So, you know, when you were putting this material together, how did you decide what to put in? I mean, obviously there's so much. You didn't include everything, did you?
No, that's a virtually impossible task. I wrote to virtually every shortwave station in the world, and of course a lot of them replied, but a lot of them didn't. So the ones who didn't weren't included in the series, unless we were able to record it through Stittsville, our receiving station near Ottawa. Mm-hmm. So it was the ones that were left out were not left out intentionally. It's just that we didn't record those at Stittsville, or the station in question didn't reply to our request.
Well, now you have Series 3 ready. And this one is titled Then and Now. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, the basis of this particular CD series is a joint program that I did back in the mid-70s, I guess, or the mid-80s. I can't remember now. I've got a very bad memory for dates. But it was a program, a joint program that Bob Zanotti and I did. Bob Zanotti, of course, was with Swiss Radio International. And we took every opportunity to do joint programs. And we did quite a few of them. And this particular joint program, and the date occurs to me now, it was 1989, which a lot of listeners will remember was the year that the Berlin Wall came tumbling down, the end of communism. Well, we did a joint program. We were both attending an international broadcasting conference in West Berlin at that time. It was still a West and an East Berlin in 1989. And we recorded that and did a joint program. Some of it was on Swiss Radio International, and the other was on Radio Canada International. So I still had the original tapes from that. So that is what is on the new CD series. And we also did an update on that because, of course, that's 20 years ago now, and an awful lot has changed in the last 20 years in the world of shortwave broadcasting. So we did an updated look at what's happened in the last 20 years to international broadcasting on shortwave. And taking part in that was Kim Andrew Elliott of the Voice of America. He used to be the host and producer of Communications World. He's now working as an audience research officer at the IBB, the International Board of Broadcasting. And also John Figliozzi, an American who is a very prolific writer on the subject of shortwave and a very avid shortwave listener. And, of course, there was Bob Zanotti involved as well, and I, and Colin Newell.
And Jeff White from Radio Miami International.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we had a roundtable discussion to try and analyze just what has happened in the world of shortwave broadcasting over the last 20 years. Because, of course, back in 1989, it was nothing but good news as far as shortwave broadcasting was concerned. And everything was gung-ho. But, of course, a lot has come down the road since 1989 in that branch of broadcasting, and a lot of stations that were on the air back then are no longer with us.
Well, thank you very much, Ian McFarland and Colin Newell. And if you want to find out more information about Series 3, which is called Then and Now, 20 Years of Shortwave Broadcasting, you can find out all the information at www.dxr.ca. That's www.dxr.ca. And you'll find out the information about that series, the previous ones, as well as all kinds of other information about international radio. So do log on and check it out. Okay, as I said, the beginning of the show, today's show is called A Tribute to DXers. And something that I always do, and that's record way more material than I actually use or actually need. So there's a lot of segments that I actually recorded for today's show that I could not use. But don't worry, for those who want to hear those segments, but I'm not going to tell you what they are right now, stay tuned because I will use some of them in upcoming Happy Station shows. So, yes, so stay tuned for that. So I want to thank everyone who helped put today's show together. Again, too many people to mention. And, you know, it was funny because the other day when I was deciding what to keep in and what not to use, I started thinking of some old things that listeners of shortwave will remember, signs and say signatures that people would use to end their shows with. And one of my favorite ones was the one that Joe Adamoff used to end Moscow Mailbag with, which was, you could not do better than to write us that letter. What's a bad Russian accent? You couldn't do better than to write us that letter. Another one that popped into my mind was one that was used on Communications World on The Voice of America for many years, which was keep your ears open and your radio on. And of course, the one that Tom Meyer ended with was so long and God bless. And there's many, many, many others. And I'd love to hear from you to find out what your favorite one was. So we can, you know, maybe come up with another show on DXing at some point in the future. We don't know, but we'll find out. Anyway, it's now time to give out our email address and our postal address, which I didn't do in the show, so hopefully you have a pen and paper handy. But first, here is the email address. It's very, very simple. pcj.happystation@gmail.com. Again, pcj.happystation@gmail.com. If you want to send a snail mail to enter the lucky draw for two shortwave radios that I'm giving away to two very lucky people, the radios are a Sanjin ATS-909 and a Sanjin ATS-606A. The address is Happy Station, 8th floor, number 47, lane 31, section 1, Sanmin Road, Banqiao, Taipei, Taiwan, ROC 22070. And I'll say that one more time. Happy Station, 8th floor, number 47, lane, L-A-N-E, 31, lane 31, section 1, S-E-C-T-I-O-N, 1, Sanmin Road, that's S-A-N like Norman, M like mother, I N like Norman Road, Banqiao, B-A-N-C-I-A-O, B-A-N-C-I-A-O, Taipei, Taiwan, R-O-C, and the postal code is 22070. I'm out of breath. I'm looking so forward to having the P.O. Box up and running, so it doesn't feel like I'm reading a script for like a who's that famous director? Cecil B. DeMille, the Cecil B. DeMille movie, which is like 3-4 hours long because it's a very long address. But if you didn't have time to write that down, send me an email, pcj.happystation@gmail.com. And you can also find the address on the website for WRMI at www.wrmi.net. Okay, then. Well, that's all we have time for. So, well, it's only now time to wish you all well. So the only thing I can end with is so long. Au revoir. Auf Wiedersehen. Adios, amigos. And sayonara.